Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report, just issuing a ton of market updates and company updates, and also trying to get all of you, the investors, questions answered regarding any of the more small-cap companies that you invest in. I'm kicking off this weekend show with Mike Larson. He is the editor of the Safe Money Report. Joins me on a bi-weekly basis on the show to break down some of the key aspects in terms of data and market moves. This week seems to be all about inflation and that inflation data, the CPI numbers that just blew away estimates. Headline CPI jumped 0.8% month over month. Core rate was up by 0.9%. These are the April numbers. The expectations were 0.2 and 0.3% respectively. The gain in the core rate was the most since 1982. Mike, inflation, at least the data is showing that it's here. Everyone's wondering, is this just transitory? We're not going to know that for at least a few more months. What's your takeaway from that inflation data?
You know, it's funny, I'm listening to your intro there and, looking at this inflation data and thinking about what the Fed's been saying when it comes to transitory and its definition of transitory. And all I could think when I saw the numbers, it's interesting, the word transitory here is supposed to mean temporary, relatively not, unnoteworthy, just sort of a passing thing that doesn't matter. But if you look at the country mile by which the forecasters missed this inflation number, it truly is shocking. I mean, you recounted some of the ways in which this is a multi-year, in some cases, multi-decade shock in terms of the size of this inflation jump, relative to history. And I think that, when you look at other data that we've seen recently, for example, on the employment front, with a lot of evidence that companies just can't find workers, there's job creation missed the mark by quite a large margin as well. There's a lot of suggestion that the Fed really is off target, and frankly, a lot of the mainstream economists are too. The reality is, when you look at how much money has been poured into the markets and the economy on both a monetary and fiscal basis, it's not all that surprising, really, that you're seeing first dramatic asset inflation and now a secondary round of actual real economy inflation. If you look at assets, whether you talk about stocks, whether you talk about risky bonds, commodities, real estate, artwork, high-end booze, sports cards, all this stuff. I mean, we've seen dramatic asset inflation such that here in the U.S., we just had, the existing home sales report for March showed the median price of an existing home rose 17% in the month of March from a year ago. We never even saw an increase that big in the height of the housing bubble in the mid-2000s, which pretty much everybody now admits was the biggest housing bubble in U.S. history. So what's going on? Again, you're printing, borrowing, and spending money at a rate that we've basically never seen in peacetime. The only thing that would be kind of a close equivalent to it is what we saw in World War II. Other than that, that's pretty much it. So, for the Fed to sit there and continue to toe the line and talk about everything being transitory and no, this doesn't matter and we're going to stick to our policies and who cares and so on and so forth, they were already looking increasingly out of touch a few months ago, which we've discussed. Now they look like they're just completely out in left field and not being in tune whatsoever with what I think the markets are seeing, what the economy is seeing, what we're all seeing in our daily lives as well.
So do you think that the Fed is going to react to this number, or is the Fed going to wait for 2-3 months, maybe more of a higher inflation print to at least talk the markets in a different direction?
Well, let's start with the numbers themselves. Again, you mentioned the inflation data was so far out of whack with what expectations were, which is exactly what we saw with the employment data not too long before that. It's just, it's going to be a short-term thing. We're going to keep watching. We're going to, we wanted to see higher inflation anyway. We're not going to do anything about it. Yada, yada, yada. And here's the problem. The markets for the last several months have been willing to shake hands with the Federal Reserve for the mutual benefit of everyone. Wall Street wants to get rich. The Fed is helping them get rich. They're throwing a bunch of platitudes out that it's all for Main Street. You know, Main Street, I'm sure, loves nothing more than not being able to afford a house, medical care, or, you know, a car for that matter, because you probably saw used cars were up 10% on a year-over-year basis. But in any event, you know, Wall Street was willing to play along. But now you have a situation where the Fed isn't even, I think we talked about this before, where the Fed has to throw the bond market a bone, has to say, you know, something like a little more vigilance talk, a little more like, okay, all right, these numbers are stronger than even we thought. So maybe, you know, if this continues, we're going to be a little more vigilant. We're going to take some steps to, you know, calm things down and so on. You know, the bond market needs to see that and needs to hear that. Wall Street increasingly, in the wake of these kinds of numbers, is going to want to see that. If the Fed doesn't follow through with something along those lines, we're going to see some of these mini tantrums that we've seen a few times as when the bond market sold off earlier this year. We're going to see that get real ugly real fast. And that's where the Fed is sort of boxed into here. It's got to signal some kind of vigilance. It's got to throw the bond market a bone. Otherwise, we're going to see interest rates continue to rise and start rising potentially sharply again. And that's going to derail this whole asset market party that Wall Street's been enjoying and the Fed's been able to point to and say, hey, we're doing anything wrong. This, you know, we'd see market turmoil. We're not. Well, you know, you're starting to see that. And that tells you that the markets are getting a little more rebellious, if you will.
So an argument being, if inflation starts to run higher, is that the Fed does have tools to calm inflation. Look at how low interest rates already are. Look at how much money they're printing. Do you agree with that statement that the Fed does have tools so that if inflation runs too hot, they will be able to step in and control it?
You know, it's not that the Fed doesn't have tools. It's that the Fed is too weak at the knees to use them. I mean, if you look back at the last cycle, forget COVID for a minute, go back to where we were, you know, 2015, or even all the way back to 2013. You know, Ben Bernanke let a few words slip in Congress about potentially tapering the massive, well, what we thought was a massive amount of QE back then. The markets, our interest rates shot up, stocks went down, and they backtracked and panicked. The Fed then said, no, don't worry. And Janet Yellen didn't start hiking interest rates till all the way in December of 2015. Then in that rate hiking cycle, they only got up to about 2.5%, and they spread those hikes out over a longer period of time than in any modern Fed interest rate hiking cycle in the preceding four decades. I went back and ran all the numbers going back to the late 1970s. So again, that was back then, even before anybody heard of COVID. They were afraid of their own shadow. They pushed their first hike way out into the future, and then their hiking cycle was drawn out even more to the point that they could only get in about 225 basis points of hikes before they gave up and threw in the towel. Now, in the wake of COVID and what's going on here, you have an even more sort of liberal, easy money-minded Federal Reserve that has said, we're going to not only keep interest rates low forever, we're not even thinking about raising them. We're going to keep to this forecast, even if inflation gets above 2%. And yet the Fed is not taking advantage of this, start singing a different tune.
So, Mike, taking this inflation data and really what I think a number of people were expecting, higher inflation, who knows how it's here for, but or how long it's here for, but fact of the matter is it's here right now. What markets do you see that impacting? Because on the back of that inflation data, we saw red almost across the board outside of the U.S. dollar and oil that was up that day.
We've talked a little bit about, I mean, kind of the term that I've heard thrown around, and I think it's actually pretty accurate, is the everything bubble. More to the point, the everything bubble in assets. We've seen enormous appreciation in assets of all kinds. I mean, I ran them off earlier, but, you know, stocks, risky bonds, real estate, both in the U.S. and Canada. And abroad, you go down the list, all kinds of collectibles, artwork, sports cards. I mean, you know, I'm a New England Patriots fan, and Tom Brady's one of his cards just sold for more than $2 million. It was like a record price. But you're seeing that across the board. It's not just a few examples. When you have assets, wealth wildly inflated by so much easy money, anything that comes along can upset the car, which is why you saw a little bit of a market reaction where it wasn't just bonds selling off, it wasn't just stocks selling off, it was both. Plus, to some degree, you know, even a little bit in precious metals, which tend to be theoretically a hedge. So, I think it's just a case that this turmoil is beginning to, you know, push me to the point where I want to take some money off the table. It's been a heck of a run. You do want to, you know, I've always been saying all along, as long as things are, that momentum is going, that money flood opportunity and environment is still working in your favor, and the markets are still shaking hands with policymakers, you don't want to fight it. You want to play along. You've seen enough in the last few days that it probably makes sense to lower, you know, take some risk off the table, step back a little bit. You know, you don't turn around and sell everything, but you do get a little more cautious because, again, if you, this mini tantrum in the bond market, if the Fed doesn't shift its tune and doesn't try and get ahead of it, that's going to be the kind of thing that is finally going to give us some real broad market volatility.
Yeah, it's been a pretty wild ride for the bond market just over the last week or two, really. And now, as we're recording this, yields continuing to rise, 10-year closing in on that 1.7%. So, Mike, just in summary, I guess you're not saying now is the time to go aggressively short on the markets, but you are seeing an opportunity here to maybe build a bit of a cash position just in case this weakness that we've seen in markets and also saw really on the back of this data broadly, there might be some more downside here, so potentially lower prices.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, you know, it's a market that's seen a remarkable amount of stability, volatility coming in. Everything's been working in the bull's way. But if you start to have, signs that central banks are losing the narrative and they're not attempting to get in front of it, and the market's starting to rebel a little bit, that's when that's the kind of signal that you've been waiting for to look at maybe taking some off the table. And I think that clearly that's what you would be doing. You know, that's a reasonable step to take here. And it's worth pointing out too, that a lot of this super overbought garbage that I've been saying all year, you don't want to chase, you want to get the heck out of your portfolio and you want to rotate into safe money type stocks and other investments. That stuff's gotten absolutely decimated. You look at some of these SPACs, these space tourism type companies, these Reddit stocks, all these things that people were chasing in January and February, stayed in that junk instead of put your money into safe money type investments, you've lost 50 or 60% of your money in just 2 or 3 months.
All right, Mike, let's wrap it up with one quick question regarding the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar up for the first 3 months of this year, down throughout April, and now in May, boy, oh boy, it's been a choppy ride, a roller coaster ride for the dollar. How are you seeing the dollar move as we progress through, let's just say, summer?
Yeah, I think, for the dollar is really going to be dependent on what the Fed does here. Are they going to take advantage of these market signals, this market data, telling them they need to change their narrative, maybe suggest or pull forward the dates in the future when they think they might have to start hiking interest rates, maybe, look to dial down QE a little bit earlier and so on. If they start changing their messaging to being like, all right, look, we kind of got it wrong, we're admitting it, we're going to now shift our approach a little bit, that would tend to be a positive for the dollar, and we'd love to see the rebound. If the Fed continues to try and just basically lie to everyone and pretend there's no problem out there and pretend when they're wrong and not try and, get ahead and recapture the narrative from the markets, then you're going to see problems. You're going to likely see the dollar sell off, bond sell off, and stock sell off too. And that's really a combination nobody wants to see. So I think we're going to have to see in the next several days, couple of weeks, whether or not the Fed's narrative starts to shift. If it does, I think that's ultimately beneficial for the dollar. If it doesn't, then, you could see things get pretty ugly pretty quick.
All right, Mike, good chatting with you. Thanks for kicking off this weekend show. And boy, oh boy, inflation, it was on everybody's mind, but this week definitely hit the forefront as we got that data that did finally extremely surprise to the upside. We'll see how that all plays into the markets as we progress through this month and into next month's data and see what the Fed has to say. Mike, thanks again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you. Same to you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that first kind of general market overview and recap of the inflation data from Mike Larson. In this segment and the next segment, I'm going to be switching a little bit more focus on the resource sector. I'm chatting now with Robert Sinn, better known as Goldfinger, on the CEO.ca website. I've had Robert on the show a couple of times before, and Robert is one of those technicians that, first of all, looks at the broader metals market and also drives down into some of the stocks. Robert, let's just start off with a quick comment on the precious metal. So gold had a volatile week this week, but it did end the week fairly strong. It's right up against that close to 1850 level, but it really looks like gold is setting up this new trading range almost between 1800 and 1850, which is just fine considering how hard of a resistance level that 1800 level was to break through. What's your assessment of the overall health of precious metals, especially gold?
Well, I think you said it best, Corey. I mean, gold is closing the week around 1840. We are in an uptrend quite clearly from the March lows. And we found a new trading range, you know, exactly as you said. So I think silver and gold look very good here. We got silver above the $27 level. That's a level it hasn't been above for an extended period of time in a while. So things are looking good. I mean, it's two steps forward and one step back. Very positive and healthy action. I feel like some money is starting to flow into the miners, just starting. It feels like it's very early stages here. But I really like what I'm seeing out there.
Okay, a couple points regarding the daily chart of gold. Gold ran right up to around that 1850 level, and that is almost exactly where that 200-day moving average is. As we're recording this, it's actually at 1854. That moving average is starting to turn down. Obviously, we want to see a break above that 200-day. A, how important is that 200-day moving average in your eyes? And also speak to the general increase in volumes that we've been seeing.
Honestly, I don't think that 200-day is very important at all. I think it's just sort of psychological, you know, like if anything, it's a flat moving average, which basically is telling you that we're in the middle of the price range the last, you know, year, essentially. We traded up to above 2,000, we traded down under 1,700, and now we're, you know, near 1850. So it doesn't mean a whole lot to me. It just means that we're in the, you know, middle of a price range. I think the more relevant factor is that gold has been making a strong uptrend since the March lows. And, you know, technically speaking, there's clearly some pretty big levels overhead around 1900. And then, you know, if we go even farther back around the 1960 level would be a really, really big level where gold, ran into heavy selling a couple of times, you know, in the last year. But, you know, right now we're in a process of an early accumulation process, you know, is what I would call this. And so we're sort of just trying to, you know, build here, and those moving averages will start to turn up over time, but it's not going to happen fast, obviously.
Any downside targets that you could share with us that investors need to be aware of? As optimistic as gold bugs can be right now after that bounce we saw in April, we do still need to be aware of downside risk here. So what are some of the levels you're watching?
Well, I mean, 1750 would be sort of a big line in the sand. I would not want to see gold back under 1750 at this point. And obviously, if we do get back under 1800, that's going to be a psychological, blow, you know, to the market, because we've made so much progress. So if this really is a strong uptrend, the pullbacks, you know, the dips, you know, they should be fairly shallow, right? So that's something that, you know, that we want to watch. If we got back under 1750, especially on a weekly closing basis, that would be a cause for some worry, and probably would send a lot of the gold miners all the way back to square one again, I would imagine.
So regarding the action in the gold stocks, we are generally continuing to see the larger miners do better than the juniors. I realize some juniors just keep on running and really have bifurcated from the market, but when you take them in a big picture sense, majors doing better than juniors. What do you take away from that environment?
I think that's positive. That's usually how it goes. you know, at the start of a move in the sector, we usually see the large caps, the seniors move first. And then, you know, later in the cycle, you know, so to speak, we see the, you know, juniors start to really move big as the seniors start to stall out. So it's a very healthy sector sort of action going on right now. And I'm just starting to see in my portfolio, some of my juniors start to move up, you know, just in the last week. And that's after, you know, a long period where we were just, you know, treading water or maybe even, you know, going lower in some names. And I've started to see some really nice moves here in the last few days.
I have too. And you know what? There's a lot of work that's going on with these juniors. And if you release good news, you can benefit from it. The market is still selling off somewhat negative drill results, though, quite hard. Now, Robert, I want to talk about a couple site visits that you went on just this week. You visited Excelsior Mining and Northern Vertex Mining, both of their projects in Arizona. Let's start with Excelsior Mining. They've had a little bit of trouble building up their in-situ mining process at their property. What did you see when you went on that site?
Well, yeah, you know, I just want to let everybody know I got off a red eye just a few hours ago. So I'm running on pretty low sleep, but, you know, hopefully I can, stay conscious here, you know, for this call. I really enjoyed, you know, the Excelsior site visit. It was a pleasure to go to Arizona and sort of see that state again and see the mining projects there. Excelsior is really, I love the project, the technology involved. It's a very clever process that they use for, you know, extracting copper in an in-situ, method. So they don't actually use any heavy equipment. There's no big trucks, driving around that site. It's basically, you know, using acid to leach the copper out of the fractured rock. And it's absolutely, brilliant process. And I saw them make some copper cathode there, about 40,000 pounds, you know, I saw in front of my own eyes there on Tuesday. But as you alluded to, they are having some ramp up issues, and there's a challenge that they've encountered where the calcite in the rock, reacts, you know, with the acid and forms these gas bubbles that's causing the flow rates to be much less than they envisioned in the feasibility study. And so I spent a lot of time talking to, you know, Excelsior management about this and the things that they're doing, how they can, you know, they can flush water, you know, they can do multiple, you know, water flushes back and forth and eventually get rid of the bubbles. But that has its own costs and takes time and requires more water. And then they're running some tests right now. They're running tests, you know, with this team of oil and gas guys to see exactly where the, you know, blockages are in these rock structures, where the gas, you know, bubbles, you know, essentially are forming. And maybe they can figure out a way, maybe using some chemicals to basically get rid of the you know, blockages. So they're doing testing right now. So they're still extracting copper. They're still essentially mining copper, but at a much lower rate than they envisioned in the feasibility study. And that's what the market is not happy about at all. And obviously, we know from mining, when things aren't going according to plan, investors sell first and ask questions later. And that's what we've seen with Excelsior. So, the management thinks that they're going to, you know, solve this problem. It's just a matter of time and money, of course. But obviously the market is acting kind of skeptical at this point, with the share price down here basically at its lowest levels of the year. So I really enjoyed the site visit. I learned a hell of a lot. But obviously I don't have a clear, answer. Is it a buy? You know, have they solved it? No, you know, we don't know yet.
All right, let's also talk about the other site visit you went on. That was at Northern Vertex Mining at the Moss Mine in Arizona. Give us a little rundown on what you saw there, please.
Really, really interesting, because this is the biggest gold mine in Arizona. Now, the state of Arizona is really well known for copper mining. Massive copper mines there, but not as well known for gold mining. And so the Moss Mine is really interesting because it's actually a pretty big operation. I was impressed. The mill there is processing more than 10,000 tons of ore per day. And obviously this is a sort of a lower grade, heap leach sort of gold mining operation where the grades are on the order of about a half gram per ton. And some of the higher grade areas are about 0.7 or 0.75. And some of the, lower grade areas are around 0.3 or 0.4. But it's a big project. And really, I think the Northern Vertex team, which is this new management team that's come in the last 6 months, their objective is to grow this project. They have a very big property package. They have a fully permitted mine. They have multiple, leach pads. They're building another pad as we speak that will probably start being in operation in a few weeks. And they've got just a lot of exciting targets for expanding this, resource. And also, they have three pits there at Moss, and they're thinking that this is eventually going to be all one big pit, one day. So the ore body runs. That's the theory, and they're doing, exploration, drilling to get confirmation of that as we speak. They're very busy and being very aggressive to sort of expand this operation. I'm a shareholder. Northern Vertex is a sponsor of Energy and Gold. I'm a shareholder of Excelsior, but they're not a sponsor of anything I'm, affiliated with. So I'm a shareholder of both, Excelsior and, Northern, Vertex. So I'm biased, obviously. But it just seems to me with Northern Vertex, this management team wants to really grow this project. I think that their goal is to get the mining operations up to 100,000 ounces per year in the next couple of years. And obviously, in order to, do that, they're going to need to do a lot more, drilling and expand the, resource. And I think we'll get a resource update from Northern Vertex by the end of this year. And this management team, I think they're very, deal oriented. And Moss is a pretty special project because you have a fully permitted mine in a really great location in Arizona. Great state, great location, lots of infrastructure. And if they can really grow this, resource size, I have a feeling they're going to be looking to get bought out for a premium. And this management team has a good, track record of, generating shareholder value, in that way.
Well, in full disclosure, I also hold Northern Vertex shares, and just interesting to hear your thoughts on both the site visits, but also on these markets, as it is still a relatively selective market for especially the juniors. But at the end of the week, we saw a bit more buying come in across the board, a lot more red on my screen, just on the number of stocks that I follow, not even own. So that's encouraging. But again, hey, hopefully this is still just early stage of a rebound and, well, more of an uptrend here. Robert, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend show. I'll have you back on in another couple weeks. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, as promised in the last segment, we're going to continue to focus on the resource sector and precious metals mostly. I am chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner over at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, the first thing that's on all the gold investors' minds is the data that came out this week, the higher inflation data finally here. I know that a lot of the gold bugs were waiting for higher inflation data for years, if not decades right now, and we finally got some pretty impressive high inflation numbers, and we saw a very kind of choppy reaction for gold on the back end of that. When the numbers were released on Wednesday, gold dropped, but pretty quickly recovered through Thursday and Friday, and has really set up this trading range, it seems like, in that 1800 to 1850 level. Now, one thing to consider, that trading range has really only been in place now for about 5 or 6 trading days. But Jeff, what was your takeaway from that inflation data and the reaction from the gold market?
There are several things. First off, you know, we looked at the gold price decline on Wednesday in the face of the CPI numbers, and we said, okay, gold prices are declining because interest rates are rising. And interest rates had actually gotten back up to, like, the 10-year rate was, like, back up to 1.69%. So we thought that gold was reacting to the interest rate. And one of the things that you'll see sometimes is when inflation rises, investors will say, okay, this is going to get out of hand and the Fed can't control it, and so I'm going to buy gold. But other times you see investors will say, okay, inflation is rising, but I think the Fed can control it, and therefore I don't need to buy gold. And I think that what you saw on Wednesday and Thursday was that interest rates rose, and people were saying, okay, inflation is rising, but the interest rates are rising too, so the Fed probably can control this. And that was reinforced by the fact that last week, Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell and other people were saying, look, there is going to be a spike in inflation numbers in the data that comes out, and it's going to be transitory. And you know, we're coming out of a deep recession. A lot of people have money stacked up. They're going to start buying things. The supply chains have not been really re-oiled, so there's going to be a lot of friction just getting stuff from point A to, you know, from producers to consumers, whether it's food or manufactured products or anything else. You know, there'll be some static, and that's going to cause us some of the inflationary pressures, but it's transitory. So I think that when the inflation numbers came out, there were a number of things working against them pushing up gold prices. One was investors had been pre-warned. They saw it coming. They understood what it was. They saw it as transitory. Second thing was that it's, you know, the old buy on the rumor, sell on the news. Last week, the price of gold rose $55 or so because people were talking about how there was going to be this transitory spike in inflation. And then the gold price fell about $25 when the inflation numbers came out. So anybody who bought when Yellen was saying, hey, watch out for higher inflation figures, was still $25 to the good, right? Buy on the rumors, sell on the news. So I think that that was one of the things. And then the third one was the interest rate. I mean, people just looked at the interest rate rising and saying, okay, I don't know how they do it, but I think that the Fed has the capacity to control this. And so this is probably a transitory thing, and I don't really need to worry about inflation. You know, that was my take on it.
Jeff, a lot of people are focusing on this transitory term, and quite frankly, we're not going to know if this inflation is transitory or not until a year or two down the road. But what factors are you going to be watching to try to give yourself a little heads up or a little foresight into the fact of, is inflation going to stick around or is it truly going to be transitory?
I think that, first off, I don't think it's going to take a year or two. And in fact, you know, one of the things with the inflation figures is you're looking at April 2021 compared to April 2020, when everything was shut down. You know, oil was $0 a barrel in Cushing for a day. You know, you had extremely weak prices and weak demand a year ago. So a year from now, people are going to be looking at April 2022 compared to April 2021, saying, oh my God, we have deflationary problems here. But in the interim, I mean, really over the next 2 or 3 months, you're going to be, you know, and we watch it. And one of the things that was very interesting this week is both the CPI and the PPI, the core inflation figures were higher than the headline figures. So headline, which includes the more volatile food and energy, actually rose less in April than the core inflation for everything else. And that was partly because in March, energy prices had shot up double-digit levels, and they were coming off in April. So we're going to watch all of those individual components to the aggregate indices, CPI and PPI, to see what's happening. And our expectation is that you'll see inflation moderate over the next several months. So it's really going to be July, August, September when we have a better idea of how transitory the high April figures were.
Now, Jeff, what about also the comparison that I think we need to watch over is that how the gold price is moving compared to U.S. equity markets, because both fell on that inflation data and both rebounded very strongly at the tail end of the week. You could even argue that the markets rebounded better than the gold price. And that continues to be one of the issues, I think, is that equity markets have been performing better than gold over a longer term time frame. What's the balance here and what is important to watch for?
Well, yeah, the balance is that you shouldn't take all your money out of the stock market and put it in gold. Yeah, we never advise that people do that. And, I remember in March of 2008, when the gold price went over $1,000, the Sunday New York Times was talking to about investors buying gold. On the front page, they had a carpenter in Iowa who had never bought gold, and he had taken all of his money out of the bank and put it into gold at $1,000 an ounce. And, within a month or two, the price was down to $900. And he was probably feeling like a schmuck. Of course, now, a year later, the price was $1,200 and he was good if he held on to it. So I think the bottom line that is that, the stock market is strong and the gold price is good too. And if you look at what's happening, people say, well, what about inflation, Jeff? You don't seem to be worried about inflation. What about all this monetary accommodation and money creation and all of the payouts on a fiscal basis that the government, not only in the United States, but around the world, are doing? That inflation is showing up in stocks and bonds and to some extent in gold and silver. It's really a financial asset inflation that you're seeing, also real estate. One of the problems with real estate, and you look at this in Canada, you look at it in the United States, and a lot of people are buying houses, but a lot of the people buying houses are actually real estate funds. And there's a tremendous amount of money that's come into the financial markets, and it's not going into general price inflation, it's going into financial asset inflation, and real estate has become a financial asset. So our expectation is the stock market continues to do well because there's this tremendous amount of money chasing yields. And there's this view that, the money's going to keep coming so we can keep doing that. That said, you've got any number of institutional investors who are very much nervous because they realize that the increase in the stock market, really since 2010, it's been almost like a machine just putting that money into the stock market, driving it up, and then you have decapitalization of the companies, which is not good for the economy, but it's very good for the shareholders and the CEOs. So you have a lot of reasons to be nervous about a stock market with a 45 or whatever it is price to earnings ratio right now. So that actually then spills over into gold because you have any number of institutional investors and family offices saying, gee, I'm really wealthy because the stock market has just been pushed higher and higher and higher by these financial shenanigans. And at some point it's going to crack. And I've got to do something to protect and capitalize some of my losses, some of my gains. I'm really wealthy right now because the stock market's rising, but this thing could go down 20%. I don't think it's going to collapse the way the perpetual perma bears have been saying, on the internet, where we're going to have a 1929 like style stock market crash in June. or whatever like that. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, there are any number of people who have done very well in the stock market, and they realize it's sort of like a game, and they're not the croupier. So you know, the house always wins in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it there. But, yeah, one thing to note is that, look, these markets are due for a correction, but maybe not that collapse that, yeah, some of the gold bug community would be hoping for, that's always hoping for. But fact of the matter is, we need to see what a pullback looks like. It can be good for gold, but it can also pull gold down. Let's switch over to silver, because the CPM Group just released their silver yearbook just on Tuesday. Jeff, take us through a little bit of the information within that silver yearbook and what you think are going to be some of the major drivers for silver this year.
Yeah, I'm really happy with the silver yearbook this year. It's the usual factors, and you know, it looks at 2020, 2021, and the big thing that drove silver prices up starting in July of 2019 was a sharp rise in investor purchases. And investor purchases of silver probably were double or more than double 2018, 2019 levels in 2020. And so far this year, we're seeing them continue to increase. So we have an even bigger increase in investment demand in 2021 than we've had in 2020. So we think that that's very positive for the stock, for the silver price over the course of the year, especially in the fourth quarter. So, you know, we go through all of the mine production, secondary recovery, fabrication demand, investment demand. We also went back and we put in a bunch of stuff that sort of addresses some of the issues that are being discussed on the internet. So we have a lot of data about mineable reserves and resources and show you that the world is not running out of mineable silver. We have data that shows you that, you know, the decline in the average grade of ore being mined by primary silver producers reflects the increase in silver prices, not that the world is running out of mineable silver. And then we also went in and we really tore apart our inventory figures, going back to the 1940s and 50s and government stocks in the United States and other governments, and sort of saying, you know, how much silver is out there in bullion form? And so we have a big section talking about that, you know, silver inventories. And in there, we actually started to put in some discussion. It's sort of a, we call it a brief history of silver market research, just so that people can better understand where these numbers come from. You know, what we find is a lot of people criticize the numbers who have never read them or never listened to us, you know, and so we're sitting there and we'll make a discussion and we'll say, this is what's going on. And then the criticisms make it clear that the person who's criticizing you actually didn't listen to what you were saying. But, you know, we put it in writing to hopefully better inform people, you know, this is the plus and minus that we've always talked about. And this is why the plus and minus, the margin for error in estimating inventories is so great. And it's very funny because, you know, one of the nice things about gold and silver, one of the things that attract people to gold and silver as investors is the secrecy surrounding it. You know, it's nobody else's liability, but it's nobody else's business how much you own. And it's that secrecy that is a prime component. And it's very funny. We point that out and we say, yeah, that makes the research that much more interesting, but also that much more difficult. And immediately somebody says, well, you know, it's secretive because it's manipulated. No. It's secretive because people don't want you or your bank or your tax authority or anybody else to know how much you've got. You know, and that's one of the reasons why people buy gold and silver.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, it is a store of value. Some people I know, very much an investment tool. I drive down into the stocks as more of an investment. But then, Jeff, what is your outlook for silver? And what is silver going to be tied to? Is it going to be tied more to gold? Is it going to be tied more to base metals? Or is it going to act all on its own this year?
I think silver will continue. It'll be more tied to gold than it will be to base metals. But, you know, it will also act more on its own. So, you know, we're looking for gold and silver both to sort of go into the summer doldrums now between May and, say, August, maybe even into September. And then prices could find some weakness there Partly, you know, I guess there is going to be increased enthusiasm about an economic recovery in the United States and other countries. But then, you know, into the final 3-4 months of the year, we think that investors will sort of pivot back toward buying more silver and more gold. And so we're looking for prices to probably start rising again in the final 3 or 4 months of the year.
Okay. Well, if anybody wants more information on the Silver Yearbook, please just email me, fleck@kereport.com. Jeff, we're going to wrap it up here. I thank you for your insights into the precious metals. It was another interesting week, especially on the back of that inflation data. But overall, I think precious metals investors do need to be encouraged by the action we've seen last month and now even carrying through the first week or two of this month. Jeff, thanks again for your time. We'll chat again in another few weeks. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too.